was in a dark, dark space for a couple of weeks. And I was thinking, why me? I was very emotional. I told my wife at one point, hey, if it's time for me to go to the other side, I'm ready. She said, she said, that's twisted, and would not hear it for a moment. But then I was lucky to pull myself out of it because I changed my view. I had viewed myself as the unluckiest person in the world. Instead, I flipped it because we can all look at a situation and decide how we are going to treat it. And what I decided was I was the luckiest man in the world because I should be dead. I should celebrate life.
This is Jeff Burningham, and welcome to the Extraordinary Us podcast, where we talk to people, talk about life, people that you may or may not have heard of. And today, I have a great friend in the studio, a lifelong mentor. As I prepped a little bit today, I couldn't help but think of all the great experiences we've had together. Fraser Bullock is here with me today.
It's great to be with you, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really fun. Let me remind you of the purpose of the podcast before we get going. Number one, no matter our differences, and we're all different. Fraser's from Canada, right?
Right.
We all are different. No matter our differences, we all have more to build on common ground from. We are all a lot more alike than we are different. We're all fellow travelers. Let's remember that and build from common ground. And because of that, number two, let's operate from a place of compassion. Less comparison, maybe less competition, and have more compassion for each other. And third and lastly, let's not let fear. We're obviously going into an unknown future. We're going to talk about the future a little bit today with hopefully another Olympics coming to Utah down the line. We don't know the future, but let's not operate out of fear. Fear causes us to make bad choices. We let mistakes of the past or fear for an unknown future cloud our judgment. Instead, let's go forward in faith. Let's go forward to change and shape the world in good ways. And again, and I mean this sincerely, and I'm sure you can hear it in my voice, Fraser, of all my, I've had 50 guests, the who's who of Utah, name them and they've been on here. But Fraser, I can't think of anyone, and I mean this sincerely, you're not going to like this, but as I thought about who's lived a better life than you, you have mentored hundreds of young up-and-coming entrepreneurs like me in the state and meant so much to us in our lives, Fraser. Thank you so much. And talk to us about a rich life. I say rich in quotes because I'm not talking about financially wealthy. I'm talking about a rich life in general. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you're too kind, Jeff, but I appreciate it very much in our friendship going way, way back.
That's right.
The way I look at life, it's a journey, one in which we are continually learning. I'm learning more today than I have at any other time in my life. Life brings you different experiences. Some are great, some are challenges, and we all have them.
Yep.
And the question is, how do we navigate those? And as we navigate those, we want to do a couple of things. Number one, we want to become better people as we navigate both positive and challenging experiences. Number two, we want to learn from those experiences how we can incorporate those into our lives such that we build a life of not just success, but happiness. And happiness, in a large way, is a product of giving.
Yeah.
And helping.
Yeah.
And so this has been, this life has been a great journey. I've got so many experiences that, hey, when I thought I left college, I thought, wow, that's my last exam. I don't have to learn anything anymore. I've got my life figured out. Whoa, was I wrong?
Yeah. I love how you said constantly learning, because I think you're a great example of that. And I think the world that we're living in now and that we're going into is kind of a world for learners. You've got to constantly be learning. There is so much changing. We live in such a dynamic world with technology and so many different things. You've got to constantly be learning. That's kind of the way of it.
It really is, because of the rate of change is accelerating.
Yep.
Just because of all the interconnectivity we have across our planet and between people and science and different things. But what you want to do is take advantage of that to be able to look in your own life and utilize the brilliant mind that each of us has been given, and to utilize that to navigate all these new things that are coming in such a way that it makes sense to you, can bring purpose to life, and can allow each of us to grow.
Yeah, I love that. I want to give a little bit more background on Fraser, who he is. And actually, I have some questions based on your background, Fraser. Fraser was an original partner at Bain Capital. And that might be a name that's familiar to a lot of people. It certainly is in finance and private equity. He then founded Sorensen Capital. And I'm going to stop there and just say, how has private equity changed, Fraser, from Bain? What year was that that you helped?
That was 1984.
Okay, so 1984. So we're talking about 30 plus years, 37 years to be exact, 38. To Sorensen Capital, which is a leading private equity firm here in Utah County. You know, how has private equity changed in your life? I'm curious, from when you started Bain to, you know, kind of finishing up here at Sorensen.
Well, to be clear, Mitt started Bain Capital. I just happened to be in the room at the same time. There were five of us.
Yeah.
But Mitt is a fabulous leader. But when I look at private equity, way back then, we thought we had a large fund. It was $37 million.
Oh, my gosh. Can you believe that?
And today, that's kind of like half a deal.
Yeah.
But back then, what we focused on was strategy of portfolio companies. And while many things have changed, certain things are constant.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, the fundamental strategy of a company is the key element upon which an investment is made. But then the dynamics have changed dramatically, because we focused mostly on leverage buyouts, and that's still a very robust industry. But what has really changed is the opportunity in tech.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of tech back then, but it's, I believe we're still in the early innings of tech investing and opportunities. So that has been a dramatic expansion. When we started Sorensen Capital, we were mostly a leveraged buyout shop because that was our heritage. But now it's 100% technology.
Because 100%?
It's 100% now. Wow. All new investments are technology investments. And that's been adapting and learning, like we do in life and everything else. We started investing a little bit in tech in Fund 1, and now in Fund 4, it's 100%, because there's so much opportunity there, so much growth. And when we look in our own backyard here, it's so great to see all these great companies that are just prospering and growing.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. For those of you who don't know, Fraser led investments in companies like Omniture, Health Catalyst, Bamboo HR, and was the chairman of the board, I think, of all those companies. Correct me if I'm wrong, or have been, or on the board of all those companies.
Yes, Omniture and Health Catalyst, but on the board of Bamboo HR.
Yeah. And how has investing in Utah changed? Obviously, I know it's changed a lot, but from your perspective, so Sorensen Capital started late 90s, early 2000?
Yeah, 2003.
Okay, 2003, sorry. So about roughly 20 years ago. How has investing changed specifically here in Utah now? I'm drilling a little bit further down. I know it's changed dramatically. As an entrepreneur myself, starting a company in 2001 out of BYU, and really having kind of one place to go for money, Vspring Capital, you'll remember that. And now to what's happening now in 2022, give us a perspective of that kind of 20-year span, especially as you pivot to technology and as technology becomes a more and more important factor in our economy here in the state. What are your thoughts or views? Curious your perspective.
Well, there are two sides to the formula. One is supply of companies, and two is supply of capital.
Yeah.
And in the early days, there were very few companies and very limited capital. And we were really a flyover state where we didn't get any interest from the coasts. And that's one of the reasons why we started Sorensen Capital, was to invest here in the state. But even then, there were a few companies, and so we did invest in Omniture, which was a great success, obviously. But what has changed is both sides of the equation. As companies like Omniture and Josh James and John Pastana, with their great success, you see the seeding from them and from companies like WordPerfect that have created an environment of technology companies and growth and entrepreneurship that naturally attracted capital.
Yep.
And so what we see today is just there's a new tech company being created every day.
Yeah.
And there is more capital here, which is fantastic because it feeds that opportunity. And so I'm glad to see all this capital coming into our state.
Yeah, when I started, the first institutional venture fund in Utah County, Peak Ventures, when was that, Fraser? 2012 or 13, 14, so 7 or 8 years ago. Fraser was kind enough to be on our advisory committee for the first number of years. That's just one of the hundreds of ways, Fraser, that you have blessed my life and helped me and leaned into things that you didn't necessarily have to, but to kind of grow the ecosystem, like you said. And even from when Peak Venture started, it's unbelievable the growth that has occurred here in Utah. I think I told you quickly before we caught up before this, I think I made 50 investments alongside, you know, my fund, alongside other funds, and just direct last year. And one of the things that's changing too is the amount of the rise of the family offices, or the amount of capital that's in Utah. Give us your take on, because that's a double-edged sword, right? When I ran for governor, I talked a lot about, oh no, we know what's coming. We need to prepare for it. This could change our way of life, the cost of housing, the affordability, traffic, the environment, et cetera. There's kind of a double-edged sword to this growth. What are some of your thoughts? Because it's great to grow. It's great to have a lot of exciting tech companies springing up. But I wonder if there are some people that feel left behind, you know?
Yes. And one of the things that we absolutely need to be cognizant of and invest in are all of the elements around the growth to support the growth so it's sustainable and people are not left behind. And that goes right to the heart of education, how important that is, how important our kids are. But then when we look at it, we also want to present them with opportunities. So once they have that education, then they have many places to go where they can develop and prosper. And and I have my children who are in various companies, and my daughter just started a company, which is super cool.
That's awesome.
And seeing that growth and opportunity is what we want to have, so that people who receive that education at the early levels can see that there's an opportunity for each one of them, and we want to open the doors for opportunities. These companies provide that because they're growing, they need to hire. And so, yes, there are some costs associated with growth, but we want to do it in a smart way to provide opportunity for the rising generation to grow.
Yeah, and in some senses, you can either participate in the future or you can kind of let it pass you by, right? This is the future. Utah is participating in a big way. I'd say we're kind of, you know, hitting out of our weight class in terms of size or whatever for that. And Fraser's been an integral part of that from the very beginning, and it's helped. Like I said, I'm one of hundreds of younger entrepreneurs that Fraser has helped throughout the years. We've already mentioned some of them. What's your favorite part before we pivot away from investing? And what's your favorite part of investing? I'm just curious. You've made a lot of investments. I do as well. I'm honestly kind of even looking for advice or just thoughts on, as you look back now, you're not actively investing as much, correct?
Correct.
As you look back, what was the most valuable part of investing? What did you learn about being a good investor, a good mentor, et cetera? Thoughts around that?
Yeah, I'll actually give you two.
Good.
Number one is I just like to help people. And so as you say, mentor, It doesn't matter if I have an investment in a company or not. If somebody needs help at any stage of a company, they've reached out to me and I help with no anticipation of any return. Whether I'm an investor or not, it doesn't matter. Just being able to help our community, help our ecosystem, help my friends, and whether it is a business problem, a personal problem, or anything else, they know I'm in their corner. That is rewarded to me. That's a big part of life, is yeah. just helping people. The second part of it is when I first graduated from college, I was a quant. That it was just all numbers. And I thought,
spreadsheet did.
I don't have a creative brain cell in my body. But what I've learned is I have developed that. It's in a book called Mindset, which is, what's your mindset? And my mindset early on was, well, I'm a quant. I don't have any creativity. But then I applied myself and I learned to grow. And I've developed a really creative mind around strategy, around investing. And I love getting into a company and thinking about the strategic issues they're facing, whether it's competition, product, whatever, and pondering those and bringing some thoughts that can be meaningful to that business to allow it to move to the next level.
Yeah, that's exciting. And you talk a lot about product leadership, you know, and I think that's something that, in my opinion, that's something you're known for as an investor, Fraser, is this term product leadership. You know, having the best product that has the best user experience or customer experience, that's a way to scale a business, is to have product leadership, correct?
Yeah, product. I started out at Bain & Company, and they talked a lot about strategy, which really laid some early neurons in my brain around strategy. And so I've always focused on that. And many years ago, I really morphed in my thinking towards product leadership. It's the foundation of everything in a company, where a company needs to continually invest, have the product roadmap, where it's going. Even if it's a service company, you're still delivering a service product. So thinking about that, where you're going, where your competition's going, where your customers' needs are going to be in the future, and being able to bring together all of the elements to be the leader in that segment.
Yeah. I think of Bamboo HR a little bit.
Yes. I mean, great example.
Yeah. Great founders, Ben Peterson, and now a great CEO, you know, Brad Rencher. I mean, it's just an exciting.
Yeah. And Ryan Sanders is one of the founders.
Yep.
Great, great people where they took something that was way too complicated for small businesses and simplified it and made elegant software easy to use that solves a myriad of problems. For the small to medium-sized businesses, that's what they want, a simple solution.
Yeah. Well, another word, and actually what I thought about when you were kind of talking at the beginning, was you were talking about being kind and serving other people, which is definitely something that you're known for, but also purpose. I feel like you've lived a purpose-driven life. For those of you who don't know, I'm going a little bit more into Fraser's background now. He was the CFO and COO of the Salt Lake Olympics in 2002 with Mitt Romney,
yes.
His good friend. You'll know, everyone will know Mitt, I think. And he's done many, many other things. I can't list them all, but one other I think of, Fraser, just because it was the last time my whole family was with you. You've been the chairman at the board at the Polynesian Cultural Center, the PCC, for some time now. We were there over spring break and got to share the luau dinner with you, and that was a fun experience, and we appreciated that. And there's a lot of talk now about the Olympics coming back to Utah in either 2030 or 2034. I want to ask a general question, then ask about that. Number one, how do you think about impact or purpose? Like you've been on not only a lot of for-profit company boards, but a lot of nonprofit boards. And in fact, sorry, I keep talking. There's so many experiences we have together, Fraser. And in fact, I don't know if you recall this. We first met in service. You were an Area Authority 70 for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was a very young bishop. And in fact, I remember what you spoke about in the training. I could tell you if you wanted. And I think the way that I recall it, you came up to me after, because again, it was 10 or so bishops and you. And you said, how old are you? By the way, I think I was 28 at the time. So I was very young. So by the way, that was 16 years ago. That's where we met. So you've had a strong focus on purpose and impact. What are your thoughts, or how have you approached that in your life?
Jeff, I can still visualize that day and say, what's this young kid doing in this room? And I said, he must. And what went through my mind right then was he must be incredibly special.
Thanks.
Proven to be true ever since that day we met.
Oh, thanks, Fraser. I appreciate that.
So,
By the way, if I could just say what you spoke about, this is in a church leadership training meeting. Some people will be familiar with those. Some listeners won't, which is fine. But what instead of Fraser talking about governance or the handbook or whatever, you spoke about loving and serving your wife, Fraser. I don't know if you remember that. But that's what you spoke about. That's one of the few of the hundreds of meetings I've sat through. It's one of the few that I remember clearly what you said. And I've tried to apply that. Anyway, so keep going.
Yeah, well, to me, that is one of the most important things we can do in our lives is to serve our spouse and love them dearly. So just one thought on service. With the Polynesian Cultural Center, yes, I've been chairman since 2013, but even though I've given innumerable hours, I have received so much more. The Polynesian people are in my heart. They have taught me ohana, which is family. The Polynesian people have a certain way about them of love and caring and family. So as I've gone through this journey of service to help the PCC, particularly through the last couple of years, very challenging.
Yeah, with COVID.
Yeah, with COVID, where we had to shut down and do different things. I have learned so much. I've grown as a person to learn the value even more deeply of loving others and ohana, that yes, we serve, we give, but we receive more in return. And in my life, that has been a universal rule.
Well, it was evident while we were over there with our family, just how much they loved you, Fraser, that people loved you. It was evident that someone special was in the house, Fraser Bullock, and Jennifer, your wife, was there as well. And it was fun for us to sit there with you. Let's talk about the Olympics. Tell us about 2002 and as much as you want to and what that experience was like. And then, which, by the way, you would have been roughly my age, a little bit older, a couple years older than I am now when you jumped into that in Denver in 2002, which is, it gives me some good perspective. It's interesting. And then tell us about the future of the Olympics, why you love the Olympic movement and what you're championing here in Utah now.
Sure. So back in, for those of you with long memories, back in 1999, there were some scandals that were revealed that were very troubling. And they needed a change in management, so they brought in Mitt. And Mitt was absolutely the right choice. He is brilliant. He's a superb leader. He's absolutely incredible along every dimension. So he was brought in as CEO in January of 1999 to turn around a very troubling situation of bribery. The FBI was investigating all kinds of people, and it was a very troubling, dark, dark time. And in the midst of that, Mitt calls me up and said, I'm looking for a chief operating officer. And I said, you're looking for somebody semi-suicidal. That's literally
what I said. And that's not me. Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, well, what about you? And I said, no. I told him no three times. But finally, he asked me to keep thinking about it. And I visited with my father and mother and was asking their opinion about it, and my father said, son, it's time to be of service. That was it. Mm-hmm. I left my career, walked away from it, took a massive pay cut.
Yeah. This is in your late 40s?
Yeah.
Mid to late 40s, yeah.
But I had a smile on my face doing it. I knew it was going to be a tough work, and we just put our heads down and went to work, and it was really, really tough. It was dark. It was hard. A lack of many of the elements of planning. But we assembled a fabulous team. I scoured the world for Olympic experts and brought them on board. And what people don't understand about the Olympics, the scale is just massive.
Yeah.
Most companies have 7 or 8 functions, sales, marketing, manufacturing. We had 42.
Yeah.
And one of those functions was technology, which was a $300 million budget. So we had all of these pieces we had to build and put together, and as we were assembling our team, as we were putting our plans together, I remember the August before our games thinking, wow, we've really done this. We've come to a point of confidence where we know we're going to do well. So I went in and told Mitt, we're going to hit this one out of the park. It looks like we're going to have a surplus. Operations are ready. It looks like it's going to go really
I know what's
well.
Coming up. Yeah.
And Mitt said, great, don't tell anybody because we want to manage expectations. But then the next conversation I can remember having him is on the phone with him just after he had driven past the Pentagon after it had been hit on the morning of 9/11.
Yeah.
And so in 4.5 months, we're supposed to host the world. And people were questioning, are we going to be able to have safe games?
Yeah.
We had countries that were saying, we're not going to come. Sponsors pulling out, people canceling ticket orders. So we'd done all this work to dig out of a hole, and we got hit again. We got knocked down. But we just went to work. We put together an even more in-depth security plan. And as a result of that, the next thing I can remember is at opening ceremonies, at the very beginning when the flag from the Twin Towers is brought in, held by 8 athletes, and hearing a pin drop as that flag is walked in, and then hearing a rousing national anthem, then going on to 17 days of marvelous competition and a very, very successful both Olympic and Paralympic Games.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, Fraser. And I'll say it, this is something I probably have never told you, but, and so I've talked about how you've mentored hundreds of entrepreneurs and blessed their lives. I mean, that's a way that you've blessed thousands of lives. Sally and I were a volunteer, a small volunteer. We did a couple of things during the Olympics. I know thousands and tens of thousands of people, correct me if I'm wrong, in Utah volunteered. I remember us going to the games. It was a bitter cold night. We had an assignment, and it was around the Medals Plaza. And we had Dallin, our youngest son, who, by the way, was like 1 year old. He was on a backpack on my back, all bundled up. And now he's, you know, at college. But, and that was such a blessing for us to be able to serve. And there were thousands of people that served, correct?
24,000.
24,000. Wow. That's awesome. So what do you love? So you have that experience, which was unbelievable and undeniable. I forget who it was. Oh, I think it was Natalie Gochner, who was on the podcast, told me about that night, Air Force One, I think it was of the opening ceremonies, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but landing and having many more people on the cabinet, the United States cabinet that they're expecting, and just the feeling of pride and joy that you all had saying, we're doing this. It's happening. We have the people with us. You know what I mean? Do you remember? Yeah, oh, I think Natalie shared that. Yeah.
No, I remember because Mitt and I went out to the airport to greet President Bush, which we did. I got to meet him for the first time, but then many members of the cabinet came out and we hosted them, and dignitaries from 43 countries, heads of state. It was a very, very big deal and worked out so well. One of the great luminaries of the Olympic movement is Jean-Claude Keeley, who's a 3-time gold medalist. He said after our games, Salt Lake, we will always remember you. These were perfect games.
I remember that quote. Yeah. So obviously you have a love of the Olympics kind of planted in your heart, I would bet. I mean, then for sure. Take us to the future now. We're talking about 2030 or 34, correct me if I'm wrong. You're now the CEO of the organizing committee for the Salt Lake City Olympic Games. I don't understand the organization exactly, but you know, give us where we're at on that and your thoughts on it and why you're excited.
Well, I love the Olympic movement because what it does, it brings people from all over the world together under the umbrella of sport in a celebration of human achievement. We watch the athletes. So Mitt brought me into that. I've loved it. I've stayed involved ever since then, helping the International Olympic Committee, the U.S. Olympic Committee, in innumerable projects to keep us relevant for when the time came, we would have the opportunity to bid again. So where we are right now is we have been selected by the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee to be the next host of a future Winter Games in the U.S. We had competition from other places. We won that competition. That is now done. Now we're looking forward to winning that competition internationally with the International Olympic Committee. So we have a group formed. It's called Salt Lake City-Utah Committee for the Games. I'm CEO. It's really a bid committee. And we've interacted with the IOC just recently several times with the governor, the mayor. Let me tell you, our governor and mayor, they love them. The IOC just...
Really?
Yeah, you were so strong. In fact, one of the meetings we had with the governor and the IOC, one of the IOC members said, Governor, I really like you. I would vote for you.
It was so and then good. Mayor Mendenhall, you're saying,
Mayor
too.
Mendenhall,
she's was, awesome, yeah.
She was fantastic. So we are on our way. The big challenge is, and it's not a challenge, it's just the reality of Los Angeles having the 2028 Summer Games, and what's the logistical opportunity or challenge putting together back-to-back games 18 months apart.
Yeah, that's
so
tough.
We're working through that. We think we have a path forward. We're working with LA. They've been nothing but fabulous in the USOPC to find a path forward, but we will be bidding on either 2030 or 2034. We want to bring the games back.
That's awesome. When will you decide? When will we decide, or will you decide whether it's 30 or 34? I'm just saying, is that a 2022 decision? Because
yes.
This sounds so far out in the future, right?
Yes.
That will happen this year.
Yes, that will happen this year.
Okay, great. And tell us a little bit more for those of you know who haven't been. Obviously, hardly no one has been as intimately involved as you have with the Olympics. I know you've taken many international trips, even over the last couple of years. You know, what's it like? What's that like? What's the work that you're doing now? Just give people a sense or flavor for what needs to be prepared 8 years or even 12 years into advance of hosting the games.
Yeah, you have to put together all the key elements of a bid, which are, first of all, the vision. Why are we doing this? Which we've been developing. It's very compelling. Number two is, do the economics work so that we can put on these games with no negative impact to taxpayers in Utah? We want to be able to look at our games operational plan, which we have a massive advantage because we have all the venues in place. They're all active. We have very experienced team members. So operationally, we are rock solid. Right now, we're out there signing hotel contracts. We've got 15,000 signed, rooms signed.
Wow.
We have our venues that we're putting under contract, whether it's Vivint Arena, whether it's Snow Basin, all of these places. So we're actually in the throes of putting together the contracts to make everything work, along with our vision, along with our budget. There's a lot of work going on.
Yeah, that's awesome. What can you share about the vision, if anything? What, you know, give people and listeners in Utah, you know, the vision or whatever, in as
sure.
much as you can share.
Sure. There's more to come.
Yeah.
But
TBD. Yep.
Yeah, at a high level, the first thing we want to do is put on extraordinary games so that everybody has an exceptional experience, especially the athletes. We are athlete-centric. We put athletes.
They are the stars of the show. Yep.
But then the other thing that we're trying to do through this is we want to make Utah a winter sports capital of the world. Not the, but a winter sports capital. We have a lot of countries that train here already. We have venues. But we want to take that to the next level and invest in sport so that our kids, our communities can participate at our venues in even a broader level, that people from all over the world come here and feel Utah's welcoming spirit, but then be able to train and develop and compete here. We want to be a magnet to the world in sport.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, most people know about the Park City venues, but when I was running for governor, I went out to Kearns and held an event with out in Kearns and met with the mayor and, you know, a bunch of and toured the ice skating facility out. It's unbelievable, right? World class. I don't know a lot about ice skating, but even when we were there, when I toured, I don't know when it was, but there were like time trials or something going on at that time. There were people from all different countries in there skating this rink and training. It's an unbelievable facility out in Kearns.
We believe it's the best in the world.
I think so.
It has the fastest ice in the world. Out of the 10 distances for long track speed skating, it holds 5 world records.
Wow.
And so we have, we believe, the best long track speed skating facility in the world, and it's still going strong today.
Have you guys heard of Under Your Bed? I bet you have by now. if you're listening to the Extraordinary Us podcast. I bet you've searched for it maybe and haven't been able to find it.
It's true.
Isn't that how life is sometimes? You just can't find constantly what you're searching for. Constantly searching.
Well, now you can.
Now we've been found. Under Our Bed is finally out. It's really there, people. So type it in right now. Search it up.
You're going to love it.
Look for it live. Subscribe and tell your friends. Can't wait to have you there with Jeff and
Sal,
providing the comedy relief. Good night, Sal.
Good night, Jeff.
I didn't think about asking this, but I'm going to pivot to this, and then I'd like to wrap up with some more service type questions. But where did you and Mitt meet? And tell it, you know, obviously Senator Romney, one of the senators from Utah right now, often misunderstood, often beloved, often not beloved. I'm saying by the general public. Where did you and Mitt meet, and what would you maybe tell as a close friend of Mitt's? What might you say about him? Again, I didn't plan this, but just curious. Sure. You've mentioned his name a couple times.
I met Mitt back in Boston at Bain & Company. I joined Bain & Company in 1980. He was a very successful VP in the firm. I was a lowly consultant just trying to find my way. And he was very kind to me. We met both in the business side and on the ecclesiastical side. And what I'll tell you about Mitt, because I worked with him over the years in Bain, the time I was there at Bain Capital, but more closely during the Olympics, because we worked together every day for 3 years. And we traveled the world together. And I'll tell you, number one, he's one of the most incredible human beings I've ever met. He is thoughtful, kind. He is absolutely brilliant. We could talk in shorthand about things because he would pick up things so quickly. He has a great vision. He's a great manager. People at the Olympics, and we at games time, we had 50,000 people between volunteers and employees and contractors. They just loved him because he was so good, so strong. He cared about his people in a big, big way. He's one of the most extraordinary leaders on our planet and the best I've ever seen. So he's just really, really strong.
Yeah, I think the reason I asked that, and I agree with you, Fraser, and I appreciate that insight. My experiences with Mitt have been similar. Whether you agree with him politically or not, this is a great person. And again, this is the purpose of the podcast. No matter our differences, we're a lot more alike. And I think Mitt Romney's a great person. I remember going to see him when I was thinking about running for governor, or maybe he was here at my house. I can't remember. But he said, Jeff, why would you ruin your life like that? He's very pragmatic too, isn't he? And a little risk adverse, I'd say.
Oh,
And he's kind of like, Jeff, why would you ruin your life? You have everything going for you. You know, and maybe it was good advice. And the other thing he said was, don't run until your kids are out of the house. And I said, Mitt, but you ran for governor when Josh and I don't remember, some of your kids were home. And yeah, I've enjoyed my interactions with him.
Yeah, he is so thoughtful and capable, and he has just a purpose-driven life. As you talked about, he tries to do the right thing.
Yeah. Oftentimes on the show, I ask guests about some of their biggest challenges or something that they've overcome, and I'm going to bring up one that I know about your life and talk about a little bit. In 2015, Fraser, you were driving to work, I believe, and had a massive heart attack called the Widowmaker, like the worst kind of heart attack you could have, I think. Obviously, you survived. It's a miraculous story how that occurred. You're welcome to share that if you want to. But what I want to ask is, you were already soft and amazing before that, pre-heart attack. Post-heart attack, though, Fraser, you're like a saint, you know, sainthood. There are some people I feel like who've kind of graduated. They don't have an axe to grind. They're just there to help. I think of Mike Leavitt, in my opinion, is kind of at this point too, where it's just like he just wants good and to help. And I certainly see that in you, always have. But post heart attack, I think that changed your perspective. Talk to us about, you know, no life is up and to the right. It's easy to look from the outside and look at Mitt Romney's life or Jeff Birmingham or Fraser Bullock or other people that you may know or see, and you think that their life's just kind of a straight line to the top. And that is not the case at all. This heart attack was certainly scary and hard for you. Tell us, you know, share some thoughts or what you learned from that experience.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, my life has certainly not been up and to the right. It's had a lot of pitfalls, and part of our challenge and our opportunity is to overcome those pitfalls. And if people could look inside my life, they say, whoa, that guy's gone through a lot.
Yeah.
But I was driving on my way to work early on a Monday morning, and as I was just driving on SR-92 in the commuter lanes, I had this massive pain hit me in my chest. I felt like I'd been hit by a truck. And I knew immediately I was in serious trouble. But I was in the middle of traffic and rush hour, and I just need to get off the road and deal with this. And so I navigate through traffic, finally find an empty space up by the outlet malls off of SR-92. And I jump out of my truck, and I'm on speakerphone with 911 because I called them and told them I'm having a heart attack. And I got out of my truck because I was in so much pain I couldn't sit there. And I'm doubled over, and the operator's asking me, where are you? Because she wants to send help. And I couldn't talk. I was in so much pain. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, okay, this might be it. And what had happened was I didn't know it, but I had a genetic blood disorder, and it created clotting in my heart, and my widowmaker artery was clotted. Survival rate is very low. It was 100% occluded. And I was talking, and I was trying to talk to her, and I couldn't, but right then a vehicle comes up and pulls up and says, can I help you? And it's my son-in-law.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, okay, that's one in a million. And in my opinion, sometimes divinity is looking out for us,
yeah,
and reached down and helped me. I had a stent put in, but I had severe heart damage where I'm permanently in heart failure for the rest of my life. And when I received that news of the heart damage, well, I was grateful to be alive, but it really hit me like a ton of bricks because heart failure is a tough thing to cope with.
Yeah.
I didn't know if I'd be able to ski again, what I'd be able to do, and I'm a very active person. So I actually went into a deep depression.
Yeah.
I'd never really been depressed in my life in a significant way, but I was in a dark, dark space for a couple of weeks, and I was thinking, why me? I was very emotional. I told my wife at one point, hey, if it's time for me to go to the other side, I'm ready. She said, that's twisted, and would not hear it for a moment. But then I was lucky to pull myself out of it because I changed my view. I had viewed myself as the unluckiest person in the world. Instead, I flipped it because we can all look at a situation and decide how we are going to treat it. And what I decided was I was the luckiest man in the world. Because I should be dead. I should celebrate life. And I came out of that, and I put a lot of thought into life and the journey for happiness and joy. And I came up with three sayings that I use. Number one is, every day is a gift.
Yeah.
Because I learned that I almost lost that gift. And so every day is a gift, and we should make every day special and recognize it for what it is. Number two is enrich relationships with kindness, because kindness and relationships are the fabric of our society. And so can I uplift somebody each day by expressing and showing kindness to them?
Yeah.
And number three is give meaningful service in whatever way. It might be in my family. It might be to my spouse. Yesterday, my wife, who's recovering from her own heart surgery, wanted a turkey sandwich from Neater's. I said, I'm on it. And I was out the door like a bullet. So just giving that meaningful service in many, many ways, because When we give service, it gets us outside of ourselves and our own problems and helps us focus and uplift others. And through that act of service, we in turn become uplifted. And so I took those and I put together a little group called Fraser's Flyers, which is a ski group that we go every Friday morning. And we use the flyers tag because we do ski fast.
Yes, we do.
Jeff is a very, very excellent skier.
Oh, not compared to you, Fraser. You ski as fast as anyone and with perfect form. I may ski fast, but not with perfect form.
Oh, you're a beautiful skier, and we're always happy when Jeff joins us. But one of the things that we do, and this is what I want to communicate, we can find purpose in uplifting others in anything we do. So Fraser's Flyers, we have a group, and we're actually skiing again tomorrow, 21 people. And we come together to ski together, to enjoy that. We exchange discussions on the chairlifts, but then we go to my house, which is on the ski run, and we have a lunch. And during that lunch, I ask a question, and everybody answers. What I have found through that is that people say, I really come for the discussion. The skiing is an extra bonus.
Yeah.
But I will ask questions like, what's the most important lesson you've learned in life? And people say, whoa. And we get into really, really deep, meaningful discussions. So we can find purpose and service and kindness in things we do every day and recognize that every day is a gift. And so through that, Jeff, yes, my life was transformed. I was completely out of control before my heart attack. I was on 20 boards trying to do too much. Heart attack let me take control again, but at a different level and in a different way.
I love that wisdom, and I love Fraser's Flyers. Again, hundreds of people have been uplifted by those three lessons and through that group. What's our question for tomorrow, by the way? Do you remember or recall, or is there a...
Yeah, the question for tomorrow is, what is the one of the most important lessons you've learned in 2021?
Awesome.
Because 2021 was a unique year.
Yes, it was. And one of our beloved flyers, by the way, and a guest on this podcast, I think season one, episode 10 or 11, Warren Osborne, you know, passed away in 2021. It was heartbreaking, of ALS. And that all this stuff will put things in perspective for you, won't they, Fraser?
Yeah, they will. And Warren was a true warrior, just a dear friend and a key participant in Fraser's Flyers. And he actually came last winter.
He did.
He couldn't lift his arms,
yeah,
but he could ski. His legs were still strong, so we had to help him dress. We had to feed him.
Yeah.
In a special way, and that was just a very kind thing that Nick Greer did. But being able to see his heroism, his example, and I'll tell you one little note. When I went to visit him in his home, not too long after he'd been diagnosed with ALS, I said, Warren, how do you feel about your happiness? And he said, well, on a scale of 10, I'm an 8 or a 9. Happiness is a choice.
Yes.
And so we look at our circumstances that can be challenging at any point in time. And how do we look at them? My heart attack, I'm either the unluckiest person in the world or I'm the luckiest person in the world, and can share and uplift with others my experience and my learnings, which has been a fabulous journey.
Yeah, that was such good learning, Fraser, and it's unbelievable. And I was amazed by Warren, how upbeat he was until the very end. You know, like he wasn't a victim. He tried his best to be happy, and I think he had learned, like you had, that happiness is a choice, no matter our circumstances.
Yes, that's it.
Well, let's wrap it up here with, you know, kind of two questions. What are you excited on? What are you focused on for 2022 as we look to the future again? I don't know if you feel this way, Fraser. I want to ask you this. I'm 44 years old. I feel like in my 44 years, there's never been a less certain time, just generally in the world. Do you agree or disagree with this? Everything seems a little uncertain. On the business side, you know, the supply chain, cryptocurrency affecting economies, inflation, the division in politics. I mean, I don't need to keep listing. Do you feel that way? And what gives you hope as you look forward? What are you focused on into the future?
That's a great question, because it is a challenging time in our world. We see different things that are very positive, but other things that are troubling. Uncertainty is a big deal. When I look at 2022, I say, okay, what's the most important thing that I, or things that I can do? Number one, I can use my Fraser's Flyers three sayings in all of my interactions with people. I can control that completely, where I seek to uplift others and through that make the world a little bit of a better place just in my own neck of the woods. So there's no uncertainty around that. The second thing, and that's with my family, my friends, and others. The second thing I look at is, what can I do on a large scale to benefit our world? And it really is bringing the Olympics back in 2022. That's going to be a big endeavor. It's very challenging. I'll be going to Beijing here in a few weeks, COVID permitting. It's a long, long journey, but well worth it. So rewarding to do something that's beneficial to the world. So I look at that as an uncertain path, but fairly clear in terms of many of the steps we need to do. And I look forward to that in a big, big way. And then finally, I'm just hopeful of what new I can learn this year. Yeah. I'm on this constant learning quest that to do a couple of things. Number one, choose happiness and choose the way to get there and have a positive outlook on life. As long as we're in this journey, we might as well have a smile on our face. And so let's go that direction. And if we have that as an undercurrent, then that will help us navigate the uncertainties of 2022.
Yeah, I love that. How could, if people want to learn more about the Olympics or help, is there anything that people can do now?
Not right now, but in the next several months, there will be things that will come up. Number one is we're going to be going around to the various communities and have kind of an open house discussion with communities and coming and supporting and being part of that. And second of all, we will launch a website later this year. Once we get more clarity around 2030 or 2034, and there will be opportunities there to participate, to volunteer, because let me tell you, being involved in the Olympics yeah. is the ride of a lifetime. As you know,
yeah,
Jeff,
it's fun. Yeah.
Thank you for volunteering.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fun. Everyone look for that. Fraser Bullock, my dear friend, my mentor, thank you for all that you've done for so many people. And it's been, thanks for coming down today. It's been awesome to be with you, as always.
And to you, Jeff, thanks for all you do.
Thanks. I hope you enjoyed and gleaned and were inspired and uplifted from the conversation that I just had with Fraser Bullock. There have been a handful of guests. I think I've done about 50 episodes, talked to so many interesting and great people. There are a couple people that, a couple of the 50 that I can't just help but gush over, I guess. And Fraser is one of those, because I have known him for almost 20 years of my life. He has been such a helper to me. And the biggest thing is, I've seen him do this. I think that there are, again, hundreds of entrepreneurs and other people that would say that about Fraser Bullock. I loved him telling the story about his, look, like I said, no lives are easy. No lives are straight to the right. I know how harrowing that heart attack was for him. I remember reaching out to him during that time, and I didn't know exactly how to help, what I could do, but I knew he was down and I was scared and I felt bad for him. Everyone goes through challenges in life. Instead of asking why me, which Fraser admitted he did, it's natural to say why me. I've done that. I do that often, almost on a daily basis. Why me? You can turn that into a choice. Happiness is a choice. I know there's a book that Fraser and I both love. It's called Solve for Happy. And it talks about how happiness is a choice no matter your circumstances. I loved his three. I love Fraser's Flyers. We do ski fast up at the canyons. And we have a great discussion. But looking at every day as a gift is a true way to look at life and a good way to look at life. Enriching relationships with kindness. I think my first question to Fraser was kind of like, What's a rich life? As I prepared this morning for a couple minutes, I just got this overwhelming gratitude and feeling for a life well lived. And, you know, he's only two thirds of the way through it, but it's unbelievable. One of the things that he's great at is enriching relationships with kindness. And relationships are really the richness of life. It doesn't matter your net worth on paper, whether it's big or small. If you have friends, if you have strong relationships, that is, I think, the true measure of a rich life. Thank you, Fraser, for sharing your wisdom with us today. We are excited. I'm excited for the Olympics again here in Utah, and we're excited to help you do that. Thank you for being a great example of the things that you've spoken about, not just speaking them, but living them as well. You have truly lived a life of purpose, and mine and so many others have been blessed by your life. And I hope that you were blessed by this conversation as well. All my listeners, please share with a friend that might be enriched or uplifted by this conversation. Until next week, this is Jeff Burningham signing off.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Us Podcast with Jeff Burningham. Please help us grow by leaving a rating and review and subscribing at your favorite podcast platform. Also, tell your friends and share on social media. See you again next week.
Hey, Jeff.
What's up, Sal?
Have you heard about me jumping out of an airplane?
Oh, did I hear about it? I was with you.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You were there.
Did you forget about me falling to my death with you?
No, I did not forget. But you can listen. If you have not heard about us jumping out of an airplane, you can listen to our podcast Under Our Bed.
Yeah, and hear about skydiving.
And all sorts of other interesting and amazing and funny things.
Hopefully mostly funny, but we've also covered some important topics this season. You know, Sally's dad passed away, and we spoke about when someone you love dies. That's been something that's been on our mind, and we've been talking a lot about, you know, in the last several months, including even last night.
Yes, we have. And so listen in and hear funny and inspirational and interesting and sad and whatever you're in the mood for. We've got it. Under Our Bed.
Check out Under Our Bed with Jeff and Sal. We'll be there.
We'll be there.